From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Prime Minister is promising more action to help get stranded British citizens out of crisis-torn Libya. Around 200 are thought to be awaiting transport to leave the country. Labour leader Ed Miliband's criticised the way ministers have dealt with the crisis.
There is a worrying whiff of incompetence about the way this government is handling this issue, and it's becoming a pattern with this government about the way that decisions are made and the way that things are handled. Frankly, I think Mr Cameron's got to get a grip on the way this government works.
More than 1,000 staff have been made redundant at Auto Windscreens after administrators failed to find a buyer. All the workers have been laid off after the UK's second largest windscreen and repair business collapsed earlier this month. No firm wanted to buy the whole business. Britain's economic slowdown at the end of 2010 was even worse than first reported. The sharp fall in GDP of 0.5% between October and December was blamed on the bad weather hitting high street sales, but a revised figure now puts the contraction at 0.6%. Joe Grice is the chief economist at the Office for National Statistics.
We've looked again at the snow figures and we still think that was worth about 0.5%. So just as a matter of arithmetic, we'd now say that there's probably a little bit more chance the economy declines slightly than it rose.
Investors on the London Stock Exchange are furious after a technical glitch stopped trading for more than 4 hours. It coincides with a new trading system which has been running for about a fortnight. A scheme to provide free books for children will have its funding slashed by half. An announcement last year that the Bookstart scheme would lose its grant altogether led to a backlash by some of the country's top writers. Ministers were pressured into a U-turn. And Prince William and Kate Middleton retraced their romantic footsteps today. The couple were guests of honour at celebrations marking the 600th anniversary of St Andrews University. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and apologies if you tuned in the last hour for Red and Griff's extravaganza. They're temporarily on Mondays, rumoured to be back on Fridays soon. So, in the week, £28 million was cut from the city's budget and protesters were dragged out of the council chamber and arrested. We ask, with all the reductions in services, what are we getting? Anything for our council tax at all nowadays? I'm joined this week by Deputy Leader of Bristol City Council representing the Lib Dems in Clifton East, Simon Cook. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, is democracy sweeping across the Middle East and North Africa, or is it? Are these changes subtle Western takeovers of countries who dare stand in the way of an attack on Iran? Well, Mubarak is gone, but has Egypt just been through a revolution, or is it a military coup? Propaganda about Libyan leader Colonel Gaddafi ordering the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher and the Lockerbie bombing is all over our newspapers and TV again, and regime change, even an invasion of Libya, is on the cards. But there will be no regime change in Bahrain, where the US 5th Fleet is anchored, despite continuing protests there. We take a tour of the region with two of Bristol's Middle Eastern expats. Libyan-born Mohamed Al-Haddad tells us how Libyan's troubles began with a mob of drunken football fans. And Palestinian journalist Iqbal Tamimi has been monitoring the Arab language news for us. And English artist Lilia Patterson has been travelling in the region through much of last year and gives us her take on the forces at work in the region too. That's in the second hour after six. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Doesn't look good, does it? Tonight, rain and lows of 9 degrees Celsius. Wet, yes, wet. This weekend, highs of 9 again. A pretty wet weekend with possibly some respite on Sunday morning. So if you want to get out and about, you better do it quick on Sunday morning. Next week, that's highs again, round about 9 Celsius, relatively dry week with some sunshine. Next weekend, the 5th and 6th of March, highs of 9 Celsius, fairly dry weekend with some sun. So best stay in this weekend and then make the most of it next week and next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and with me is Lib Dem councillor for Clifton East. That's Simon Cook. Hi, Simon. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Now, you're also deputy leader of Bristol City Council, and you're on the cabinet. So how does the machinations of the cabinet work?
How does it work? Well, we have a leader, obviously, who and all eight of us have a portfolio, so we share the council's departments and services between us, and we collectively take decisions at key decisions at cabinet meetings. And a key decision is anything that involves expenditure of over £500,000. But we also we are present at a lot of delegated officer decisions as well, and officers will obviously want us to be comfortable with the decisions that they take, so we have a great deal of influence on all decisions within the council.
But what about openness? Are the minutes of your cabinet meetings open to the public, and can the public come and sit and watch as you make your deliberations?
Yeah, all cabinet meetings are conducted in public and the minutes are available.
Okay, one of the big decisions coming up next week is the Sainsbury's in Southville. This is the big one, isn't it? Which way is it going to go, do you think?
I've no idea. The officers have recommended refusal of the application. They are saying that it's a marginal decision, because if you recall, the first application that Sainsbury's put in was recommended for approval by the officers, and then the members turned it down. They turned it down on the basis of a retail impact on North Street, the transport plan, and sustainability within the building itself. The new application claims to have addressed that, but the GVA Grimley report on retail impact has come out that it would be slightly more adverse than the first report. So the officers felt this purely on that one issue. They're satisfied on the transport and sustainability. On that one issue, they felt they had to recommend refusal.
Now, these planning officers who've made these advice work for you, Simon. Didn't there a little bit of arm-twisting going on behind the scenes?
No, we can't do that. It is not possible for either politicians or the chief executive or senior management to tell a planning officer, particularly the chief planning officer, what recommendation to make. They have to interpret the law, planning law, and that's what they've done in this case. They do stay in the report. I mean, it is clear in the report that it is marginal, and that if members feel that they want to take a different view on officers' advice, obviously, then they may or may not do that. But that's planning decision by the planning committee, and that's quasi-judicial, and it's completely independent of party politics.
But it's all a bit of a paper exercise, isn't it, really? Because Sainsbury's, if you refuse them, are just going to simply appeal, and then it's going to eat up a load more of our public money fighting that appeal.
Well, there is an appeal set on the first application already for the beginning of May. A hearing is set. Yes, you're absolutely right. But it's a planning application can be submitted. It has to be heard. We have to determine it. The planning officers have to interpret the report, interpret the facts as they see them within the framework of planning law, and then the members have to take a decision. So we'll see what they come up with.
But can't Sainsbury's simply just avalanche you with loads of planning applications, one after another, until you cave in?
I don't know.
Well, they've done with two this time, haven't they?
They've done it with two. I wouldn't think that, having appealed the first one, I would imagine that they would wait. If the second one is turned down, I would imagine they would wait for the appeal to be determined on the first one, which probably would be announced sort of midsummer. But it remains to be seen. I honestly don't know.
Now, it's budget-cutting time of year, about 10% off the city budget in a single year. That was announced this Tuesday. This is not going to be popular for you, Simon, as your party, the Lib Dems. And if you want the Lib Dems elected this May, you're going to need votes in the city, not to mention what the effect the LibCon Alliance in Westminster is having.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've worked very hard at the budget. We've done our utmost to protect frontline services. Certainly in my area, culture, sport, capital projects, there is no effect on service delivery at all of this budget. So I feel that you know, we've worked hard. It's a robust budget, and we will sell its merits. And no, you're right, the voters must make their choice.
But the council isn't really employing people at the moment, is it? You're allowing people, when they leave, posts are not being refilled, so there's bound to be some impact on the service delivery.
Well, it depends. That we have had a policy over the last 18 months, 2 years, of vacancy management, and that is very much testing what is attainable with certain staff levels. So it remains to be seen. But as I said, in the area that I'm responsible for, I can't see there's going to be any change in service delivery at all.
Do you think there is going to be an effect of the National Libcon Alliance on the way people vote here in Bristol?
Who knows? I don't know. You know, we like to think that our administration is running the city well. If people choose to use a local vote to reflect a national trend, then there's nothing we can do about that. But for us, these are local elections. They're about who runs the city, not about who runs the country. The country after May the 5th will still be run by the coalition.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here with me too. Now, Martin, economic downturn was announced this morning as minus 0.6% growth rather than minus 0.5% as we'd heard earlier in the year. Does this really make much of a difference? And what does it mean for the wider picture?
Well, I think it does. I think, you know, councils up and down the country, whoever is in control, are having very difficult decisions to make, because the overall policy of cuts, I believed to be wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong, Simon, but a number of Liberal Democrat councils have signed an open letter, have they not, saying that the cuts are too savage, basically, too quick. I don't know whether Bristol has bought into that.
Yeah, we did sign that.
You did sign that, yes, because John Keely was here the other week and he was saying exactly that.
Mm. But isn't this just a way, Simon?
Obviously, that's something that I would agree with.
But isn't this just a way of
trying
to sidestep the political impact of what's going on at Westminster?
No, I think we need an adult discussion about the serious mess we are in. I mean, we've got an Irish general election going on this today, and they are deciding whether they are going to carry on with the cuts policy. They're being put under an awful lot of pressure by outside forces to carry on with the deflationary policy, but I suspect the Irish electorate will kick it out. And if they do, of course, that means that the City of London will take the hit, along with Frankfurt and the other people that are owed money by the Irish banks.
So growth down by 0.6%. Does that actually mean a double-dip recession?
That is the implication, is it not? I think a lot of these things would have been the same whoever won the election last May. Because of the mess that everything has got into. But I think in the longer term, we're going to have a serious discussion, for example, about local taxation. I mean, the idea of giving certain councils complete fiscal autonomy has been suggested now. Now, if you do that, we're starting to ask questions about how local government is financed. I mean, in Britain, it's mostly financed through central government spending, subvention, and council tax is actually a rather minor part of the fundraising powers. But in other parts of Europe, you have local government funded by local income tax, property taxes. I mean, we're going to have to start thinking about rebooting our taxation system to deal with the problems that are coming up.
Now, Simon, I saw you nodding away there. Given that you've signed this letter, which is really questioning this the depth that the cuts are taking, I mean, do you think you're going to have any influence through doing that?
No, probably not. I think central government have set their course and they're going to stick by it. It is a difficult process. And whilst I think this year's budget has been relatively painless, you know, next year's is going to be challenging. And it was local government, Liberal Democrat-run local authorities just flagging up that how difficult they're finding it. No, I doubt it will change central government policy. I mean, central government's taking the view we need sharp pain now to give confidence, and they're banking on the fact the private sector will come in behind and mop up the employment. I think that's a moot point. We have to, the jury's out on that.
Now, we've had quite a lot of protest over the last week or so. I think this is all based really around this budget setting meeting that was happening on Tuesday at the Council House. Thousands of protesters, we're told by the Bristol Evening Post, marched through the city centre to show, this is last Saturday, their anger over public sector cuts. An estimated crowd of 3,000 people met up to hear a rallying call at Castle Park before making their way down Union Street onto the centre en route to the Council House and College Green. The long line of demonstrators, among them pensioners, teachers, health workers, union members and students carried banners and blew whistles chanting the message to oppose the government's austerity cuts. They said the most vulnerable would be hit hardest, frontline services affected, with many banners pointing to the bonuses of the bankers. It was organised by the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Spokesman Robin Clapp said the event was planned just days before the City Council was due to announce these cuts. John McAnally, Bristol-based National Vice President of the Public and Commercial Services Union, said this is a real demonstration of anger from the people of Bristol against the cuts, which are not inevitable. It's not just the trade unionists and politicians, it's the ordinary citizens who are prepared to demonstrate in these numbers. Do you think that there is a point to what they're saying there? Because it seems that people are actually really angry about this, Simon.
Well, I mean, people have a perfect right to protest, and so they should, and make their voice known. And I have to say, at the council meeting, the protest was very small. It was very vocal and very organised, but it was about 10 people.
Okay, Martin, what about you? Did you go along to any of these protests?
Did you see anything yourself? I attended the protest last Saturday, yeah. I think basically most people I recognise that Bristol City Council are in a difficult situation because of the overall policy that's being pursued. I think the overall policy, as Simon said, the jury's out on it, but if by the summer it's clear that we are going into recession and that the deficit is getting bigger, that will be the killer, because people will begin to realise that cutting actually increases the deficit. Most people are, frankly, economically illiterate, and they don't realise this. It has to be spelled out to them so that they see actually cuts increases the deficit. And that's what happened in Ireland, and that's why the Irish general election is the most crucial election in the Republic's history, because they're possibly going to repudiate the whole idea of cuts as a strategy. And if they do, that's going to set the cat among the pigeons with the European monetary system, you know, the Eurozone and all the rest of it.
Well, Simon, your party as a whole seems to have its sort of fingers crossed behind its back in a way, saying, well, we do hope that the private sector delivers a bit of growth for us, because otherwise you're in deep doo-doos, aren't you?
Well, I mean, we've responded to what was a difficult situation when no one won the election. And you can either sit back, sit on your hands and let a minority government, for instance, take control, but that's not stable, it's not robust. So we felt it was the right thing to do. It was the only arrangement where the numbers stacked up, because if Labour had stayed leading the government, I think there'd been a huge lack of confidence in international markets, and love them or hate them, they're there and they matter. But also, you know, with all the nationalists, all the Lib Dems, everyone together, there still wouldn't have been a majority. So the Conservative Liberal coalition, I think, was the only option. And yes, I mean, it's you know, coalition is difficult, but Europe has survived remarkably well on coalition government for decades now. And I'm hoping that it's a little bit of maturity creeping into our system.
I don't see there's any problem with coalitions. They are normal everywhere else. There'll be a coalition in Ireland on Saturday morning for sure. The question is the policy, rather than, you know, coalitions are just normal stuff. That's just plain football. It's a question of what the tactics are. I think, interestingly enough, if we'd had an AV election or a PR election, the numbers would have stacked up rather differently, and different coalitions would then have been feasible.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I'm all for that, as we know.
So am I. But I think one of the problems we're going to have with this AV referendum in May is that hostility amongst the Labour voters towards the coalition is going to colour their votes on AV. And I'm somebody that wants to see it passed, as does Ed Miliband, who was here the other week.
Just to clarify, AV is this alternative vote system.
Yeah, I mean, right. And in a sense, I mean, I understand that Brown and the Labour cabinet offered the Liberal Democrats a PR referendum if they were to join with
that's
them.
That's proportional course, representation.
Yeah.
I think that Brown might have done, but yes. There's a whole section of the Parliamentary Labour Party, like Jack Straw, who weren't having it.
The trouble is, Martin, of course, that is
probably what spiked that as a possibility.
Labour and the Conservative parties, Martin, really don't seem to like this, because the current first-past-the-post system favours them, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but I mean, what we've had in Labour politics is we've been in power for a generation and basically sold out most of the things we believed in, because the system forces people to move to the centre and doesn't allow them to make their case coherently. The case against the cuts possibly isn't even a majority case yet, but you've got to make that case before it can be a majority. What happens is that the whole debate gets boiled down to a very narrow field, where we all agree that there's going to be cuts. Actually, most of the parties that stood in the election didn't agree that there was going to be cuts. The, you know, the nationalist parties, for example, Green Party, you know, various left-wing splinter parties, which would definitely have got a couple of MPs if there was a different electoral system, would all have been against cuts. And you can see the Irish system is more flexible, and that is one of the reasons why they may chuck the whole policy out.
Well, we'll see what happens in Ireland this evening. Right, now on to our next news story. Placemaking director stays despite the row over funding. This is Councillor Peter Abraham, apparently, from Stoke Bishop, was scathing in his criticism of the placemaking director's role. Simon, you're one of the big fans of the placemaking director. What does he do? I mean, it seems he's on quite a large salary, £72,000 a year, employee of Bristol City Council.
He's actually not on that full salary because he's not working 5 days a week. He's working 4 days a week. This was proposed by the Bristol Partnership, and it will be partly funded by the university.
Can you explain what the partnership is?
Well, it's a partnership between the key stakeholders in the city, and it's to do with
who are they? Who are those key stakeholders?
Well, it's the university, it's business, it's the NHS, it's the city council, it's the key people who run our services, public and otherwise, and private in the city, and. This follows on from Destination Bristol some time ago had a report done by a company called Yellow Railroad, and it was about how we present ourselves internationally and nationally as a city, and that's geared towards gaining more inward investment, more business relocation, better skill, attracting better skills, skilled people, although we have a good base of skilled people, but we will still, for our businesses, universities, hospitals, all the rest, we still need more. We need to attract the right people, and it's how we do that. It's always said that in Bristol's a city that hides its light under a bushel, and I think that's very true. I think it was Helen Holland, Labour leader, who said, no, we not only hide our light under a bushel, we then stuff the bushel under the chair and sit on it. And I think that's very much, and this is about building the profile of the city nationally. Tourism to the city is worth a billion a year to the city's economy. That's a huge amount, and that is highly beneficial to the people who work here in all the ancillary services.
But Conservative Councillor Peter Abraham is saying, make more of Christmas, do more stuff on the Downs. We've got a joker coming over the hill telling us to do more on twinning. That you should come up with this absolutely amazes me. It's insulting to our staff and the people of Bristol. This is a Conservative Councillor Peter Abrahams.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I thought it was quite appalling speech. He didn't at all refer to why we've appointed this position, and it is about building. You know, for me, I mean, I'm in charge of culture in the city. Culture, you know, leads economic regeneration. It attracts people to the city. It builds us a reputation. It makes people look at Bristol, and it builds our profile. These things are important. Whether you like them, it's very easy just to take the Mickey out of them like that. And Mike has come up with a whole range of ideas, which will resonate in national press and international press. It'll do what the Banksy exhibition did for Bristol. These things are important, you know, and it's a relatively small amount of money we're spending just to boost that side of the city's profile.
Well, Labour Councillor Mark Bradshaw is a bit more prosaic. He's saying this role is not needed. It can be done by officers already in post. We should be spending the money on reversing the damaging cuts to the Meals on Wheels service.
Yeah, but it was backed by his leader when it was first mooted. So it's all very convenient. These things are budget amendments. They're not seriously political ideas. They're about putting headlines in political leaflets. That's what you have to understand about Budget Council. Actually, they produce a whole range of budgets. It tinkers at the surface of this vast budget. You know, they tinker around with a few thousand pounds when you're talking about, you know, sort of 400 million. And in general turnover and capital, all the rest, a billion. So, you know, it's I'm afraid, this is all political theatre. It's really got nothing at all to do with substance.
Martin, even on 4 days a week, this chap's going to be on probably over 50 grand. Is it really necessary? Do you think useful?
Well, I think that what the problem is, we end up arguing about what cuts there should be. And this role, obviously, there was consensus about such a role in the first place, from what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. And presumably, if we had the resources, that consensus would have stood up. And I think Simon's right. There's an element of kind of Punch and Judy about this. Whoever is in charge of the council would face the fact that the central government has got the wrong policy, and that's what's got to be addressed, and quickly, because if the economy goes down the drain, you get into deflation. It's very hard to get out of. We haven't had deflation in this country, proper deflation, for a generation, and people will be very, very shocked when we get there. And it's not just a question of tinkering at the edges. You've got to actually look at the whole thing in the round and say, look, the policy isn't going to work. But that's not to be decided at the level of Bristol City Council.
Well, Jack FM, moving on to the next story, are telling us this week that 12,000 Bristol children are living in poverty. Save the Children is calling on the government to act amid fears that the rate could increase in the current economic climate. According to the charity, a lone parent family with one child aged under 14 in severe poverty is living on an income of less than £7,000 a year. And a couple with two children under 14 is on less than £12,500. That is 16% of the total child population in Bristol falls into that category. Simon.
Haven't read that, hadn't heard that, so difficult to comment without looking at the detail, but you know, one hopes that isn't true. But I haven't had a chance to have a look at that.
One of the things they're saying is if the government is to fulfil its commitments on child poverty, it must find a way of counting these children in the greatest need. At the moment, these children are hidden from official view and their plight is unrecognised. Adds Sally, who's someone from Save the Children Fund, if these children are to have a future, we must acknowledge their desperate need and urgently target government help towards them. Sounds to me like what with all these cuts, this is all going in the wrong direction and there's going to be more children in poverty, not less.
Well, without looking at the detail of it, it's difficult for me to comment. I don't, you know, look, we need to do things about desperate poverty, and we will do our utmost in the coalition government to make sure that we continue to do that. But obviously we're in an appallingly difficult economic situation, and there are being severe cuts. I don't think they're as severe here as they are in other parts of the country. But we need to invest in real terms. I actually like to think that our flagship policy of the last election, which will be delivered by the coalition, which is the first £10,000 being taken out of tax altogether, will help these people a lot. And I think that should have been done a long time ago. And, you know, when you think that Labour cut the 10p tax rate, I'm pleased that that will be delivered by the end of this Parliament.
Now, I know what you're going to say, Martin. You're going to say 12,000 Bristol children living in poverty, we should just be spending more money on them, and we shouldn't be cutting at all.
The comment I was going to make, I mean, I used to be an officer for the council in the Economic Regeneration Department, and one of the things that was very striking, I mean, Bristol's a very successful city compared to other cities, but we've still got pockets of deprivation that are nearly as bad as anywhere in the country. Mm. And what that says to me is that even when the economy is running at full belt, as it's supposed to do, it doesn't really touch this underclass of people. And of course, in a recession, depression, that underclass also inevitably grows in numbers. Also, a crisis like this is also an opportunity to change the way we think about these things. I mean, in Scandinavia, for example, they really do get to grips with this stuff and try and get something sorted out. But it means higher taxes on wealthy people. There's no doubt about it. And we've got to be honest in saying that. You know, if you're going to do something about this, you can't just print the money. People in Clifton will have to take out their checkbooks if they want to live in a society where we put this in the past.
Now, whether Save the Children have got it right or not, Simon, I mean, we really
quite a lot of my constituents are not rich people. No, I have to say, they live in flats. Oh, and,
sure.
You know,
I mean, I'm just saying, whoever the wealthy are, they don't all live in Clifton, we know that.
Yeah, whether or not Save the Children have got this right, Simon, I mean, it really is something quite serious we're looking at here, because we're storing up problems for the future if our children are increasingly in poverty, as we hear 16,000 in Bristol right now, and possibly more in the future.
Yeah, no, I think education's got a big part to play. I'm pleased that education standards are going the right way, but you know, we need to get to children when they're still young to make sure that you know, they don't fall into the poverty trap when they grow up as well. And that's really crucially important.
Now, Marina Morris is joining us, and I think you've got some something on alcohol today, Marina.
Yes. This week, new figures have been published by Alcohol Concern, which suggests that the number of people being treated in hospital for alcohol misuse has more than doubled in the last 8 years. According to the annual survey from the Office for National Statistics, heavy drinking is falling, abstinence is rising, and young people are leading the drive towards healthy drinking. Historically, the sales of alcohol increased and fell with the economy. Recession in the early 80s and 90s were linked with slumps in drinking. Since 2008-09, alcohol consumption in the UK has fallen by 6%. Pubs have closed down, duty on beer has risen, while sales of cheap supermarket wine has increased. However, the price of a drink as a percentage of disposable income is cheaper than ever before. Alcohol is cheaper, and collectively we are drinking less of it. But the danger of alcohol, however, have not disappeared. According to the Alcohol Concern, there are still 10 million people drinking above the government's recommended level, but 1.6 million dependent drinkers. The health warnings are here to stay, and rightly so, as hospital admission from alcohol continue to rise. Medics, led by Professor Sir Ian Gilmore, have published a report that poor alcohol regulation could cost up to 250,000 lives in England and Wales over the next 20 years. They also said the coalition government was too close to the drinks industry, but welcome the coalition government's plans to keep duty rises on alcohol at 2% above inflation. British alcohol taxes and prices are already among the highest in the Europe. Previous research by Professor David Nutt identified alcohol as the most harmful drug in today's society.
Okay, Marina, thanks very much. I think one of the things for me that comes out of this almost more than anything else, Simon, is the fact that we're having less and less pubs. It seems that people are actually just buying their drinks in the supermarket, and this is actually having quite a change on the way we interact with each other in society, isn't it? What on earth can we do to halt the close down of pubs? Although we don't want people to be quite drinking so much, we also don't want to lose those pubs, do we?
No, I mean, I spent a lot of time in pubs in my time, but they're a lot more pleasant to be in now with the smoking ban, I have to say. That has meant that some people will stay at home rather than go to the pub because they can't smoke. But it is undoubtedly true that supermarkets are... whatever the government does in terms of putting duty on, and I don't think the government puts enough duty on alcohol, whatever the government does, you always seem to be able to find bottles of wine and beer at extremely low prices in supermarkets, and it never seems to be affected. They just seem to take the hit on the bottom line, I suppose, more and more, and access the stuff more and more in bigger and bigger bulk, more and more cheaply. So I think you're right, Tony. I think the pattern is changing. Look, there's nothing wrong with having a glass of wine with your family at home. I shall go home this evening and probably have a glass of wine with my daughter and my son and my daughter's boyfriend, and that will be very pleasant over the meal. But I would hate to see our pubs close down. I love going out for a beer, and it's a great British institution. So I hope that we can reverse that trend. But it's a difficult one because, as David Nutt, who used to, of course, be here at the BRI and at the university, he has highlighted quite dramatically that alcohol is actually more harmful than certain prohibited drugs.
But there is some serious side to this, isn't there, in that in economic hard times, people often turn to alcohol to drown their sorrows.
Yeah, I suppose so. We'll wait. I mean, we just heard that actually consumption of alcohol is going down slightly. We'll wait and see what the trend will be. I hope people don't drown their sorrows. I hope that, in difficult times when people often get put into difficult financial situations, I hope, that we can maintain services to make sure that people have other avenues to go and not go out and get legless.
Martin Summers, you've been known to be spotted down at the Plough in Easton. What are your thoughts about what we've heard from Marina there? Mainly about, I suppose, the change in the way we're drinking and the dangers of it.
Well, I think we need to take a step back and look at all of this. As Simon pointed out, drink is probably more dangerous than many prohibited drugs. Advertising of alcohol on television still continues. I can't see why we allow that. In the 1930s, when the Social Democrats took over in Sweden, they had a massive drink problem. People getting up in the morning and getting legless on vodka. And what they did there is they basically nationalised the drinks industry. You could only buy drink from a registered shop, which was provided by the government. They had very definite opening hours and so on. And Sweden managed to change completely its drink culture over a generation. But it involved the complete nationalisation of the drinks industry. And there was no private production of alcohol. There was an alcohol monopoly by the state. People, it sounds crazy to us in Britain. That would never work. That's not the sort of thing we could do. I wonder, isn't it? Other developed countries have this kind of policies. Why don't we?
Yeah, I think there's a actually interesting, because I went to Norway with a Norwegian friend three years ago, on his boat, and if you go to a bar there, you have a couple of pints and it's 24 quid or something. Yeah. It's absolutely phenomenal.
Wages are higher,
but he was saying that there is underneath there is a heavy drinking culture at home of spirits. Which seems somehow to be built into the northern European psyche. I don't know why, but certainly public drinking, and you can't find an off licence, and when you do, and the prices are horrendous. But underneath it, there is a kind of private drinking culture where people are still making themselves ill by drinking huge amounts of spirits, which actually doesn't happen quite so much here. It's more of a kind of lager culture here and wine culture. A lot of young kids drink vodka, I suppose, when they start out.
I think Marina pointed out, the alcohol prices in Britain are some of the highest in Europe, but we've still got very high consumption. I think our society is pretty boozy. I mean, historically, that was the image that Britain had, you know, in France and everywhere else. You know, the British, they're at it again. Yeah. And I'm afraid that's a long-term thing that takes a long time to change, you know.
Okay, well, taking the discussion culturally upmarket a little bit, Marina Morris has been out on the streets again this week, and she's been asking, in the wake of the library closures, do we still want and need our libraries?
Nationally, 485 libraries have recently closed or are threatened this closure. Is this a mistake, and who's harmed by closing libraries?
Yes, I think it's a mistake. Who would be harmed would be like children, pensioners, anybody in search of learning or knowledge.
Our education is built on the availability of information, so if they were to close libraries, I'm sure there would be a large part of the community that would be prevented from gaining the information they need, because although majority of us use the internet to collect our information, I'm sure there's still a large amount of people who don't have access to the internet. Libraries are there to help that, and the impacts are far wider than I think most people really understand. So closing libraries without real much forethought is, I think is really a mistake.
That's a destruction of a culture, I believe. Not only a mistake, but a destruction of a culture. I would say there are lots of people who are benefiting from these facilities. They should be kept for sure.
I don't think it's a mistake. You just buy books or go on eBay and buy books.
I think it could be a mistake for the older people who don't necessarily have online access, or they're not as good with the online world. But I think, to be honest, a lot of younger people wouldn't think of going to a library in the first place.
Well, I suppose it is a bad thing, but most times children and probably older people that might feel that they can use the library to pass the time away. So, I mean, I don't use the library that much anyway. I suppose kids and older people would.
How often and why do you use libraries?
At least once a week. I'd go there to read the daily papers. Yeah, I'd lose that access. Not everybody has access to the internet. People prefer books. They're part of our culture and history. In the past, politicians didn't want us to have libraries. So I think they're an important part of our culture. They need to be kept. If they need to adapt to the times and changing with sort of like internet connection, computers, fine. But they're a place where everybody can go and learn and enjoy. They're very, very important to us.
Not any longer, but when I was young, I used to spend a lot of time in libraries. There were no computers, but in those days, my majority of my time is spent on working in offices. So.
That's Marina Morris's Vox Pop there about libraries, a little bit of which we heard, I believe, last week. Sorry about that. But anyway, we're joined by Mr. Libraries, Simon Cook, who's a Lib Dem councillor for Clifton, and also deputy leader of Bristol City Council. Well, it looks like we're not going to be losing libraries in Bristol, Simon.
No, in fact, last year we opened an additional one. And we are rebuilding some, but the Junction 3 is due to start construction quite soon. In Eastern, and
Also, we'll start construction fairly soon on the Bishopston Library, which is the replacement for the Cheltenham Road one. We've just completed a refurbishment, £1.3 million refurbishment of six of our libraries across the city. That's taken a couple of years. We're investing in libraries, and we believe in them. And we think they've got a great role to play in our communities, you know. But libraries are changing. I mean, it's not just about books anymore. It's about computers. It's about IT. It's about people getting on the internet, and it's about DVDs and CDs. So we're broadening the appeal. But I think they're incredibly important. I think a lot of people can't afford computers, the internet's a key part of the modern world. So I think libraries got a very, very important role to play. And you know, I've spoken to so many people who said that their local library was absolutely crucial to them when they were growing up, and they went there, borrowed books, and actually sometimes went there to work.
Well, obviously I agree with that, and we need to invest in libraries, but let's hope that the overall macroeconomic stance of the government doesn't lead to a situation where all the money runs out.
Okay, and another story this week. We've heard that, well, moving from books to magazines, and actually, no, you do get magazines in the libraries, don't you, too? Mm-hmm. We hear this week that the Venue magazine is to close. Venue is the weekly listings magazine, plus it's got lots of journalism in it, too, but it's basically, you know, pretty much a snapshot of Bristol's culture and what's coming up in the next week, every week. This is a bit of a tragedy, Simon, isn't it, that such an important magazine has only got two more issues to go and then that's it?
Yeah, no, I think it's terrible. I mean, I love that Venue. I think it's a great magazine. I think it's really, really useful for people to know what's going on in Bristol and Bath. And there's some really interesting stuff, reviews and articles in it. So I was gobsmacked and really, really disappointed to hear that. There is a little bit of chink of light in that the founders all those years ago are saying that, you know, maybe they'll try and organise for it to continue. So let's hope that something can be done. But no, I agree. It's a great loss to the city.
Now, the ownership of it is quite important, because when it started, it was an independent magazine. And then the owners thought, well, we'll see if we can do a similar kind of thing in Cardiff. And they lost a lot of money. So they got bought out by Northcliffe, which is the regional arm of the Daily Mail, which owns the Bristol Evening Post and Western Daily Press. And they bring out their own sort of little listings magazine every Wednesday in the Evening Post. So do you think possibly this is why the Evening Post people, the Northcliffe people, have just decided, well, we're going to close this down and just do our own? There's no sense in duplicating this as a supplement to the Evening Post. We can bring this kind of thing out every Wednesday.
I think the regional arm is probably losing money. And
no, it's not. It's making quite a lot of money, actually.
Okay, well, I don't know. I mean, the rationale of why they've done it would be down to the bean counters in Northcliffe, presumably. But I think it's very sad. The kind of what's on supplement in the Bristol Evening Post is good, and but you know it doesn't really equal the sort of good reviews you get and the articles that appear.
No, well, certainly so, the extent and the detail of the listings are nothing like as good as the Venue.
No, it doesn't get into the kind of, you know, the street music and the vibrant music scene as Venue does. So I think it's a great loss, but something tells me that a way will be found. But it's about money. The city council hasn't got it. We can't do it. But hopefully that we can or something can happen that Venue can continue.
Yeah, well, the most significant thing that I can see in this article is the twin causes of this unhappy event are declining sales and, much more important, a catastrophic falling off in advertising revenue in recent months. It's called double-dip recession, and it hits everything.
Well, it's the same as, I suppose, in the jobs section of the Evening Post, that there's a massive decrease in that. It used to be something like 7-8 pages of jobs. Now there's just 2 pages.
These are all straws in the wind, aren't they?
But the owners are still making money. They don't have to close it. I think it certainly appears that they have chosen to close it to make a bit more money.
Possibly.
Well, in the 60s, when Time Out was originally set up, it wasn't really a money-making concept. It was a sort of countercultural
This is
happening.
London Listings Magazine.
Yes, I know, but I mean, all the listings magazines have grown from that original route. I mean, I think that people will find ways to market their gigs and so on. There will be other things will come out. You know, they will have networks, Twitter sites, whatever. You know.
Well, let's just hope that Venue is about the people who put it together and not just about the money, and that they manage to get something together in the next few weeks or months. On to another story now, and over the last couple of weeks we've been reading about interesting discoveries in Cheddar Gorge. Well, it's not quite Bristol, it's just down south a little bit. Now this is if I could just read this little piece from the Daily Mail this week. With a blood-curdling shriek, the shaman raised his stone dagger high above his head before plunging it into the chest of his young female victim. The pretty 17-year-old had been chosen by lot to die in this manner was, after all, an honour, a way of winning the favour of the gods and guaranteeing a period of plenty for her friends and family. Her mind was clouded by a cocktail of hemlock and hallucinatory herbs prepared by the tribe's elder womenfolk, and her limbs hung limp from her body as she was laid out over the sacred rock. Yet she had not gone to her death quietly, for while the herbal concoction was soporific, it could not soothe the agony of ritual death. As the knife, fashioned from the naturally occurring volcanic glass obsidian, cut through flesh and bone, her piercing cries set the craggy village dogs baying in the warmth of the fire and howling, a cacophony soon echoed by the wolves prowling the limestone crags 400 feet above the encampment. Well, I better not go on. But this is all about the discovery of some sacred objects which were thought to have been simply bits of skulls and things. But it now is shown that actually these were basically human bones which were actually bitten and then carved by humans. And that the people who were living down in Cheddar Gorge, in Gough's Cave, were actually cannibals. Now, maybe we'll start with you, Martin, on this one. Does this come as any surprise to you? That some of the earliest,
I think
ritual skulls.
The Daily Mail
have come from
basically sexed up.
This
that
is not
story.
Just the Daily Mail. Okay, yes, I realise that. But this is actually quite an important discovery that's been made. That the earliest ritual skulls. Actually, in the whole of Europe, have been found down
well,
in Cheddar
Gorge. It's fascinating, and they've also shown from the DNA that local people are related. Hundreds of local people are related to the people who used to live in that cave. They found one local teacher who was related to it, and that was considered to be amazing. That after 9,000 years, one local teacher was actually related. But they've now found quite a lot of people are related. And that just goes to show, doesn't it? I mean, archaeology is fascinating to me at the moment because we're learning so much new stuff all the time because of the new techniques that are being used. It's not that surprising that people... I mean, what I understand that the cannibalism being suggested here is basically how do you dispose of the dead? You're in Ice Age Britain, it's freezing cold, you've got a dead body, grandma soup.
Moving on to the more sensible part of the article, it says, so why exactly were they eating people? The truth, archaeologists believe, is chilling. It seems a taste for human flesh may have long been a defining characteristic of our species. It does seem to be a long-term behaviour that we see in humans, says Professor Stringer of the Natural History Museum in London. Simon?
Well, it makes you wonder what goes on in the depths of Cheddar, doesn't it? No, truly fascinating. I mean, actually very surprising. I thought that cannibalism was very, very rare, but obviously not. And I don't know. I mean, it's something that's been found in other parts of the world, and so I suppose if you're looking at it in a kind of logical way, there's no reason at all why it shouldn't have happened here. No, what a fascinating discovery. And it's amazing, isn't it? These local places, these caves, you go on making these discoveries. The world is an ever fascinating place.
Moving on to another story. Julian Assange from WikiLeaks is to be extradited to Sweden. This is from The Guardian on Thursday. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is to be extradited to Sweden to face allegations of rape and sexual assault. Assange has been fighting extradition since he was arrested and bailed in December and consistently denied the allegation made by two women in August last year. Now, what is going on here, Martin? Is this a normal bit of extradition here, or is it just an attempt to get at WikiLeaks?
Well, I think we've got to distinguish between Julian Assange, the person, and his personal behaviour, and WikiLeaks and the stories that have come out through WikiLeaks. I think, this is for the law. The law must take its course. I trust the Swedes, in fact, not to be manipulated. I hope they're not being manipulated, although there is some questions. I mean, he's going to appeal.
One of the most important things in all of this is, of course, that there haven't actually yet, at least as of Thursday, been any charges laid in Sweden against Assange.
Well, as I understand it, he had consensual sex with these people, but he didn't, and they're not happy with him not using a condom and stuff like this. Now, this is Sweden. this wouldn't necessarily be illegal in Britain.
So what do you think? Is it coincidence that this has come along right now? Simon, what do you think about this one?
It depends whether you're a conspiracy theorist or a cock-up theorist, really, doesn't it? I mean, a conspiracy theorist will see this as an attempt to try and silence him, to shut him away, and therefore kind of silence the movement which he represents. So I don't know. It's a very strange kind of coincidence. But as you say, he'll,
so which
he'll
are
obviously
you?
Appeal.
A coincidence theory
no,
or
I'm
a conspiracy?
Theorist, oh, okay. I'm afraid. I find conspiracy theories are too far-fetched.
What about this European arrest warrant, though? Because, as I was saying, there still hasn't actually been any formal charges in Sweden laid against him.
Well, I mean, one hopes that, you know, all the European partners have as kind of rigorous a judicial system as we do. I'm sure the Swedes do, actually. Well, I've just read that trilogy of books, you know, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, and it makes you wonder about the Swedish police and the Swedish establishment. But, I mean, that was a thriller. So I don't know, but certainly there are other parts in the European community where the judicial system is not as rigorous, and you do worry when people or citizens from here or from anywhere else get arrested, and you worry that they don't have the sort of treatment that we would expect to get here.
What about Assange himself, though? Is he a threat to national security, or is he a hero?
I don't know. I mean, again, it's a cock-up. For instance, I mean, the last bolt of stuff that he released, you know, why was it available to the average squaddie in American squaddie in Afghanistan to access from his laptop? You know, all this kind of classified stuff. So the security protocols obviously hadn't been put in place as they should have been, and he got hold of it and released it. Now, if you don't have the security protocols in place, somebody's going to get hold of them and release them. It's irresponsible if it puts somebody else's life at risk, but that is again, it's a fine definition. I don't know. I mean, I'm a great one for saying, look, that as much information as can be put in the public domain should be, but you know, if it proves that something getting out is harmful to national security or to whoever, then I don't think it should happen. But it's a complex one. But on balance, the fact that this can happen is somewhat more reassuring than the fact that you go to other parts of the world where it couldn't possibly ever happen.
Yeah, I think what I want to know about Julian Assange is where his funding comes from. I want some transparency.
Well, apparently George Soros is one of his funders.
Well, indeed. But he's rather cagey about that. I mean, the other people who are engaged in the same game of leaking things, like the Al Jazeera leaked all of the Palestinian negotiating positions. Mm. So this is now becoming a trend. I mean, people are seeing that this is a way to get results. Mm. But what can happen with leaks is that you are actually being manipulated by the leaking. The leakers are manipulating you. Mm. And so, for example, Netanyahu in Israel said, "We will not be damaged by WikiLeaks." He came out and said that. And I'd like to know how he knows that. How does he know he's not going to be damaged by WikiLeaks? And this is the kind of questions that are actually being asked on the internet about Assange. People who've worked with him in the past say that he's egotistical, that he's not transparent about his funding, and things of this sort. And I want to see the same kind of spotlight on him as we've got on the governments. The governments deserve to have the spotlight. Some of the stuff that's come out is truly shocking, and you know, they deserve to be exposed. But I want to know who's doing the exposing.
Okay, on to another an international story now, and this is Pakistan's intelligence is ready to split with the CIA, we're told by the Associated Press in Islamabad. Pakistan's ISI spy agency is ready to split with the CIA because frustration over what it calls heavy-handed pressure and its anger over what it believes is covert US operations involving hundreds of contract spies actually within Pakistan. And this is basically about some chap called Raymond Davis, who's been arrested. And let's just hear a little report from Pakistan, from Pakistan Television, about who this Raymond Davis is and what he is supposed to have done. Apparently he's some kind of Rambo character running around as an American terrorist in Pakistan.
Davis is the head of a much larger snake. The equipment and the photographs and the evidence that has come out from Davis so far almost confirm his links with the Taliban-Pakistan terrorism inside in Pakistan, the attacks on ISI and security establishment in the armed forces, as well as the drone attacks. So, with this kind of evidence, The issue is not just of the assassination of those two boys on the streets of Lahore, but it is of identifying the much larger network of CIA espionage and sabotage inside Pakistan. The access which the Americans had to him has now been restricted. Cameras have been installed in his cell. Security cordon has been increased. And there are even suspicions that even CIA might try to assassinate him just to keep him silent. Because there's much more to the incident than what meets the eye. The pressure is also coming on the Pakistan government to hand over Davis to the Americans. But the issue of Davis now is almost out of the hands of the Pakistani government, but it's more into the hands of the army and the security establishment. So this is where the case stands now. Americans are in thick mess.
Americans are in big mess, at least according to Pakistan TV. Martin, do you want to start on this one? Who is this Raymond Davis guy, and why is it important that he's been arrested in Pakistan?
Well, I mean, I don't know who he is. It would be silly for me to pretend otherwise. I mean, he's obviously an American agent of some sort. I think what I do actually look quite a lot at the Pakistani English language press, and it's actually extremely good. Their journalists are very dedicated. A lot of them get killed either by the government or by terrorists, of the anti-government terrorists. A lot of them pay the very high price for the high quality of their journalism. In Pakistan itself, there is a wide belief in the educated classes that America, the US, is trying to destabilize Pakistan by encouraging terrorism within Pakistan. So I'm not saying whether that's true or not. I'm just saying that lawyers, doctors, teachers, army officers in Pakistan definitely believe that to be the case.
Well, what they're saying by the Associated Press is that Pakistan intelligence had no idea who Davis was or what he was doing when he was arrested with these various grenades, machine guns and things like this. The official said, adding that there are concerns about how many more Raymond Davises are out there. Now, Simon, this isn't really winning hearts and minds out in Pakistan, is it, if we find a sort of American Rambo character, armed to the teeth, blowing things up?
No, well, I've always sort of wondered whether the whole fact that we're in Afghanistan is to do with Pakistan, it's to do with that stability, the stability of that country, and ultimately the West's desire to control the Pakistani nuclear bomb, because they are terrified of the thought that that could get into the hands of extremist Islamic terrorists. So I think it's I mean, the Americans are obviously in Pakistan in a big way, and they want to be able to control the stability of that whole region to the West's advantage. And the fact that people like this are around, obviously they have operatives of all kinds, it doesn't surprise me at all that these kind of people are popping up occasionally.
Okay, so final story is to do with David Cameron over in the Middle East at the moment, who's been doing as many arms deals as it can. Let's have a listen to somebody from the Campaign Against the Arms Trade.
Well, of course, one of the main reasons for going at the moment is because there's a big arms fair in Abu Dhabi, IDEX, and there are, I believe, around 36 British firms exhibiting there, including the big ones like BAE, TALS, UK, Babcock, Kinetic, and so on. It's because arms sales are very, very lucrative. The UK is cutting its own Ministry of Defence spending. The US is cutting its defence spending. Lots of countries in the recession are cutting back. So they look for other places to sell arms, and that means overseas. And they see the Middle East particularly as a very rich market. So they're all going all out to sell arms there. It's, as I say, it's not just the UK. Other countries are doing exactly the same.
Now, Martin, do you want to start on this one? Well, what is Mr. Cameron up to?
Well, he's out there selling arms, which Britain has been doing in this region for a long time, whether that's right or wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. One would love a world where you didn't have to have arms. If we don't sell them, somebody else will. But no, ultimately, it's a perverse trade.
Lib Dem councillor and deputy leader of Bristol City Council, Simon, thank you very much for joining us. Be back after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Britain